Cord and I passed through the cupola, moving slowly so that she could take in the carvings and the mechanism. Then we were on our way up. I let her go ahead of me so that she could get an unobstructed view, and so that I could steady her if she got dizzy. For we were high above the ground here, climbing over the curve of a stone buttress that seemed about as thick as a bird's bone when you looked at it from the ground. She gripped the iron banisters with both hands and took it slowly and seemed to enjoy it. Then we passed through an embrasure, sort of a deep, complicated Mathic archway, built into the corner of the presidium at about the level of the belfries. From here, there was only one way up, a series of stairs that spiraled up the inside of the presidium just inside its tracery walls. Few tourists were game for that much climbing, and many of the avowed were extramuros, so we had the whole presidium to ourselves. I let her enjoy the view down to the chancel floor. The courts of the wardens immediately below us were cloister-shaped, which is to say that each had a big square hole in the middle where the presidium shot through it, lined with a walkway with sight lines down to the chancel and up to the Starhenge. Cord traced the bell ropes up from the balcony and satisfied herself that they were in fact connected to a carillon. But from here it was obvious that other things, too, were connected to the bells. Shafts and chains leading down from the chronochasm where automatic mechanisms chimed the hours. It was inevitable that she'd want to see this. Up we went, trudging around like a couple of ants spiraling up a well shaft, pausing now and then to catch our breaths and to give Cord leisure to inspect the clockwork and to figure out how the stones had been fitted together. This part of the building was much simpler because there was no need to contend with vaults and buttresses, so the architects had really gotten out of hand with the tracery. The walls were a fractal foam of hand-carved interlocking stone. She was fascinated. I couldn't stand to look at it. The amount of time I had spent as a fid cleaning bird droppings off of this stone and the clockworks inside.
"So you can't come up here except during Appert?"
she asserted at one point.
"What makes you think that?"
"Well, you're not allowed to have contact with people outside your math, right? But if you and the one-offs and the hundreders and thousanders could all use this stairway any time you wanted, you'd be bumping into each other."
"Look at how the stairway is designed," I said. "There's almost no part of it that we can't see, so we just keep our distance from each other."
"What if it's dark? Or what if you go to the top and bump into someone at the Starhenge?
Remember that portcullis we went through?
On top of the tower?"
"Yeah. Well, remember, there's three more towers. Each one has a similar portcullis."
"One for each of the maths?"
"Exactly. During the hours of darkness, all but one of them is closed by the Master of the Keys. That's a hierarch, a deputy of the Warden Regulant. So on one night, the tenors might have sole access to the stair and the Starhenge. Next night, it might be the hundreders, and so on."
When we reached the altitude where the sentry weight was poised on its rail, we paused for a minute so that Cord could look at it. We also looked out through the tracery of the south wall to the machine hall where she worked. I retraced my morning's walk and picked out the house of Jessery's family on the hill. Cord was still looking for flaws in our discipline.
"These wardens and so on,
hierarchs," I said.
"They communicate with all of the maths, I guess.
And also with the Eda and the secular world and other consents.
So, when you talk to one of them..."
"Well, look," I said. "One of the misconceptions people have is that the maths are supposed to be hermetically sealed. But that was never the idea. The kinds of cases you are asking about are handled by disciplined conduct. We keep our distance from those not of our math. We are silent and hooded when necessary to avoid leakage of information. If we absolutely must communicate with someone in another math, we do it through the hierarchs. And they have all sorts of special training so that they can talk to, say, a thousander, in a way that won't allow any secular information to pass into his mind. That's why hierarchs have those outfits, those hairstyles. Those literally have not changed in 3,700 years. They speak only in a very conservative ancient version of Orth. And we also have ways to communicate without speech. So, for example, if Ra Orlo wishes to observe a particular star 5 nights in a row, he'll explain his plan to the primate, and if it seems reasonable,
The primate will direct the master of the keys to keep our portcullis open those nights, but leave all the others closed. All of them are visible from the maths, so the millenarian cosmographers can look down and see how it is and know that they won't be using the Starhenge tonight. And we can also use the labyrinths between the maths for certain kinds of communication, such as passing objects or people back and forth. But there's nothing we can do to prevent aircraft from flying over, or loud music from being heard over the walls. In an earlier age, skyscrapers looked down on us for 2 centuries. That last detail was of interest to Cord. Did you see those old I-beams stacked in the machine hall? Were those the frames of the skyscrapers? It's hard to imagine what else they'd be. We have a box of old phototypes showing those things being dragged to our place by teams of slaves.
Do the phototypes have date prints?
Yeah, they're from about 700 years ago. What does the landscape in the background look like? A ruined city, or...
She shook her head.
Forest with big trees. In some of those pictures, they are rolling the beams over logs.
Well, there was a collapse of civilization right around 2800, so it all fits together, I said.
The chronochasm was laced through with shafts and chains that in some places converged to clock movements. The chains that led up from the weights terminated up here in clusters of bearings and gears. Cord had been growingly exasperated by something, and now, finally, she let it out.
This just isn't the way to do it.
Do what? Build a clock that's supposed to keep going for thousands of years.
Why not?
Well, just look at all those chains, for one thing. All the pins, the bearing surfaces, the linkages. Each one a place where something can break, wear out, get dirty, corrode. What were the designers thinking, anyway?
They were thinking that plenty of avowed would always be here to maintain it, I answered.
But I take your point. Some of the other millennium clocks are more like what you have in mind, designed so that they can run for millennia with no maintenance at all. It just depends on what sort of statement the designer wanted to make.
That gave her much food for thought, so we climbed in silence for a while.
I took the lead since, above a certain point, there was no direct route. We had to dodge and wind among diverse catwalks and stairs, each of which had been put there to provide access to a movement, which was fine with Cord. In fact, she spent so much time working out how the clock functioned that I became restless and thought about the meal being served at this moment in our refectory. Then I recollected that it was Appert, and I could go extramuros if I wanted and beg for a cheeseburg. Cord, accustomed to being able to eat whenever she pleased, wasn't concerned about this at all. She watched a complex of bone-like levers wrestling with one another.
Those remind me of the part I made for Saman this morning.
I held up my hands. Don't tell me his name or anything, I pleaded.
Why can't you talk to the Eta? She asked, suddenly irritated. It's stupid. Some of them are very intelligent.
Yesterday I would have laughed at any artisan who was so presumptuous as to pass judgment on the intelligence of anyone who lived in a consent, even an Eta. But Cord was my sib. She shared a lot of my sequences and had as much intrinsic intelligence as I. Fraws were sterile, so that we could not impregnate sewers and breed a species of more intelligent humans inside the consents. Genetically, we were all cut from the same cloth.
It's kind of like hygiene, I said.
You think the Eta are dirty?
Hygiene isn't really about dirt. It's about germs. It's to prevent the spread of sequences that are dangerous if they are allowed to propagate. We don't think the Eta are dirty in the sense of not washing, but their whole purpose is to work with information that spreads in a promiscuous way.
Why? What is the point? Who came up with all these stupid rules? What were they afraid of?
She was quite loud. I'd have cringed if she had talked this way in the refectory. But I was happy to hear her out alone in this chasm of patient, deaf machines. As we resumed our ascent, I searched for some explanation to which her mind might be open. We had passed above most of the complicated stuff now, the machines that moved the clock's dials. All that remained were 6 vertical shafts that ran up through holes in the roof to connect with things on the Starhenge, polar drives for the telescopes, and the zenith synchronizer that adjusted the clock's time every day at noon, every clear day anyway. Our final approach to the Starhenge was a spiral stair that coiled around the largest of those shafts,
the one that rotated, the great telescope of Sans Mithra and Mylax.
That big machine you use to cut the metal, it's called a five-axis electrical discharge mill. Well, I noticed it had cranks made for human hands. After the job was finished, you turned them to move the table this way and that, and I'll bet you could also use those cranks to cut a shape, couldn't you?
She shrugged.
Sure, a very simple shape.
But when you take your hands off the cranks and turn control over to the synthetic device, it becomes a much more capable tool, doesn't it?
Infinitely more. There's almost no shape you couldn't make with a SynDev-controlled machine.
She slid her hand down to her hip and drew out a pocket watch and let it dangle at the end of a silver chain made of fluid, seamless links.
This chain is my journeyman piece. I cut it from a solid bar of titanium.
I took a moment to feel the chain. It was like a trickle of ice water over my fingers.
Well, SynDevs can have the same amplifying effect on other kinds of tools. Tools for reading and writing genetic sequences, for example. For adjusting proteins, for programmatic nucleosynthesis.
I don't know what those are.
Because no one does them anymore.
Then how do you know about them?
Oh, we study them, in the abstract, when we are learning about the first and second sacs.
Well, I don't know what those are either, so I wish you would just get to the point.
We'd been standing at the top of the stair that led up to the Starhenge. I pushed the door open and we walked outside, squinting in the light.
Cord had gotten a little testy.
From watching Orlo talk to artisans like Fleck and Quinn, I knew how impatient they could be with what they saw as our winding and indirect way of talking. So I shut up for a minute and let her look around. We were on the roof of the Presidium, which was a great disk of stone reinforced by vault work. It was nearly flat, but bulged up slightly in the middle to shed rainwater. Its stones were graven and inlaid with curves and symbols of cosmography. Around its perimeter, megaliths stood to mark where certain cosmic bodies rose and set at different times of the year. Inside of that ring, several freestanding structures had been erected. The tallest of these, right in the center, was the pinnacle, wrapped in a double helix of external stairs. Its top was the highest part of the minster. The most voluminous structures up here were the twin domes of the big telescope. Dotted around from place to place were a few much smaller telescope domes, a windowless laboratory where we worked with the photomnemonic tablets, and a heated chapel where Orlo liked to work and to lecture his fids. I led Cord in that direction. We passed through two consecutive doors of massive iron-bound hardwood, the weather could get rough up here, and came into a small, quiet room that, with its arches and its stained glass rosettes, looked like something out of the old Mathic age. Resting on a table, just where I had left it, was the photomnemonic tablet that Orlo had given me. It was a disk about the size of my two hands held side by side and three fingers thick, made of dark, glassy stuff. Buried in it was the image of Sant Tancred's nebula, dull and hard to make out, until I slid it away from the pool of sunlight coming in the window.
"That's about the bulkiest phototype I've ever seen," Cord said.
"Is that like some ancient technology?"
"It's more than that. A phototype captures one moment. It doesn't have a time dimension. You see how the image seems close to the upper surface?"
"Yeah."
I put a fingertip to the side of the tablet and slid it downwards. The image receded into the glass, following my finger. As it did, the nebula changed, contracting into itself. The fixed stars around it did not change their positions. When my fingertip reached the bottom of the tablet, the nebula had focused itself into a single star of extraordinary brilliance. At the bottom layer of the tablet, we're looking at Tancred's star on the very night it exploded in 490. Practically at the same moment that its light penetrated our atmosphere, Sant Tancred looked up and noticed it. He ran and put a photomnemonic tablet, just like this one, into the great telescope of his consent and aimed it at that supernova. The tablet remained lodged there, taking pictures of the explosion every single clear night until 2999, when finally they took it out and made a number of copies for distribution to the Thousanders.
"I see things like this all the time in the background of spec fiction spielies," Cord said.
but I didn't realize that they were explosions.
She traced her finger up the side of the tablet a few times, running it forward thousands of years in a second.
But it couldn't be more obvious.
The tablet has all kinds of other functions, I said, and showed her how to zoom in on one part of the image, up to its resolution limit. That's when Cord saw the point I was making.
This, she said, pointing at the tablet. This has got to have some kind of SynDev built into it.
Yes, which makes it much more powerful than a phototype, just as your five-axis mill is much more powerful because of its brain.
But isn't that a violation of your discipline?
Certain proxies were grandfathered in, like the new matter in our spheres and our bolts, and like these tablets.
They were grandfathered in?
When?
When were all of these decisions made?
At the convoxes following the first and second sacs, I said. You see, even after the end of the praxic age, the consents obtained a huge amount of power by coupling processors that had been invented by their syntactic faculties to other kinds of tools, in one case for making new matter, and in the other for manipulating sequences. This reminded people of the terrible events and led to the first and second sacs. Our rules concerning the ETA and which proxies we can and can't use date from those times. This was still too abstract for Cord's taste, but suddenly she got an idea, and her eyes sprang open.
Are you talking about the incanters?
Out of some stupid involuntary reflex, I turned my head to look out the window in the direction of the Millenarian Math, a fortress on a crag, on a level with the top of this tower, but shielded from view by its walls. Cord took this in. Worse, she seemed to have expected it. The myth of the incanters originated in the days leading up to the third sack, I said.
And their enemies, what do you call them?
Rutters.
Yeah, what's the difference exactly?
She was giving me the most innocent, expectant look, twirling her watch chain around her finger. I couldn't bear to level with her, to let her know what stupid questions she was asking.
If you've been watching those kinds of spielies, you know more about it than I do, I said.
One sort of glib explanation I heard once was that Redders could change the past and were glad to do it, but incanters could change the future and were reluctant. She nodded as if this weren't a load of rubbish.
Forced to by what the Redders had done.
I shrugged. Again, it all depends on what work of fiction you happen to be enjoying.
But those guys would be incanters, she said,
nodding at the crag. I was getting a little restless, so I led her back out onto the open roof, where she immediately turned her gaze back to the Thousander's Math. I finally worked it out that she was merely trying to reassure herself that the strange people living up there on the crag that loomed over her town were not dangerous. And I was happy to help her, especially if she might go out and spread the good news to others. That sort of fence-mending was the whole purpose of Appert. But I didn't want to lie to her either.
Our Thousanders are a little different, I said. Down in the other maths, like the one where I live, different orders are mixed together. But up on the crag, they all belong to one order, the Edharians, who trace their lineage back to Halicarn. And to the extent there is any truth whatsoever in the folk tales you're talking about, that would put them on the incanter side of things.
That seemed to satisfy her where Rhetor and Cantor wars were concerned. We continued wandering around the Starhenge, though I had to give wide berth to an Eta who emerged from a utility shack with a coil of red cable slung over his shoulder. Cord noticed this.
What's the point of having the Eta around if you have to go to all of this trouble to avoid them? Wouldn't it be simpler to send them packing?
They keep certain parts of the clock running.
I could do that. It's not that hard.
Well, to tell you the truth, we ask ourselves the same question.
And being who you are, you must have 12 different answers.
Well, there is a sort of traditional belief that they spy on us for the secular power.
Ah, which is why you despise them.
Yeah.
What makes you think they're spying on you?
Voco. An aught where a fra or sewer is called out from the math, evoked, and goes to do something praxic for the Pangendrums. We never see them again.
They just vanish?
We sing a certain anathem, a song of mourning and farewell,
as we watched them walk out of the minster and get on a horse or climb into a helicopter or something, and, yes, vanish is fair.
What do the Eta have to do with that?
Well, let's say that the secular power needs a disease cured. How can they possibly know which Fra or Sur out of all the consents happens to be an expert in that disease?
She thought about this as we clambered up the spiral stair that wrapped up and around the pinnacle. Each tread was a slab of rock cantilevered straight out from the side of the building. A daring design, and one that required some daring from anyone who would climb it, since there was no railing.
This all sounds pretty convenient for the powers that be, Cord commented. Has it ever occurred to you that all this fear about the terrible events and the encanters is just a stick they keep handy to smack you with to make you do what they want?
That is Sant Patagar's assertion, and it dates from the 29th century, I told her. She snorted.
I'll bite. What happened to Sant Patagar?
Actually, she flourished for a while and founded her own order. There might still be chapters of it somewhere.
Oh, it's frustrating talking to you. Every idea my little mind can come up with has already been come up with by some Sant 2,000 years ago and talked to death.
I really don't mean to be a smarty pants, I said, but that is Sant Laura's proposition, and it dates to the 16th century.
She laughed.
Really?
Really?
Literally 2,000 years ago, a Sant put forth the idea that...
That every idea the human mind could come up with had already been come up with by that time. It is a very influential idea.
But wait a minute. Wasn't Sant Laura's idea a new idea?
According to Orthodox Paleolorites, it was the last idea.
Ah. Well then, I have to ask,
what have we all been doing in here for the 2,100 years since the last idea was come up with?
Yeah, to be blunt about it.
Not everyone agrees with this proposition. Everyone loves to hate the Lorites. Some call her a warmed-over mystagogue and worse, but Lorites are good to have around.
How do you figure?
Whenever anyone comes up with an idea that they think is new, the Lorites converge on it like jackals and try to prove that it's actually 5,000 years old or something. And more often than not, they're right. It's annoying and humiliating, but at least it prevents people from wasting time rehashing old stuff. And the Lorites have to be excellent scholars in order to do what they do.
So, I take it you're not a Lorite.
No. If you like irony, you might enjoy knowing that after Laura's death, her own Fid determined that her ideas had all been anticipated by a peregrine philosopher 4,000 years earlier.
That's funny. But doesn't it prove Laura's point?
I'm trying to figure out what's in it for you. Why do you stay? Ideas are good things to have, even if they are old. Even to understand the most advanced theorics requires a lifetime of study. To keep the existing stock of ideas alive requires all of this. And I waved my arm around at the consent spread out below us.
So you're like, I don't know, a gardener tending a bunch of rare flowers. This is like your greenhouse. You have to keep the greenhouse up and running forever or the flowers will go extinct. But you never...
We rarely come up with new flowers, I admitted. But sometimes one will get hit with a cosmic ray. Which brings me to the subject of this stuff you see up here.
Yeah, what is it? I've been looking at this pokey thing my whole life and thinking it had a telescope on top, with a crinkly old Fra peering through it.
We had reached the top of the pokey thing, the pinnacle. Its roof was a slab of stone about twice as wide as I was tall. There were a couple of odd-looking devices up here, but no telescopes. The telescopes are down in those domes, I said, but you might not even recognize them as such. I got ready to explain how the new matter mirrors worked, using guide star lasers to probe the atmosphere for density fluctuations, then changing their shape to cancel out the resulting distortions, gathering the light and bouncing it into a photomnemonic tablet. But she was more interested in deciphering what was right in front of her. One was a quartz prism, bigger than my head, held in the grip of a muscular Sant carved out of marble and pointed south. Without any explanation from me, Cord saw how sunlight entering into one face of the prism was bounced downwards through a hole in the roof to shine on some metallic construct within.
This I've heard of, she said. It synchronizes the clock every day at noon, right?
unless it's cloudy, I said. But even during a nuclear winter, when it can be cloudy for 100 years, the clock doesn't get too far out of whack. What's this thing? She asked, pointing to a dome of glass about the size of my fist, aimed straight up. It was mounted at the top of a pedestal of carven stone that rose to about the same height as the prism-holding statue. It's got to be some kind of a telescope because I see the slot where you put in the photomnemonic tablet, she said, and poked at an opening in the pedestal just beneath the lens. But this thing doesn't look like it can move. How do you aim it? It can't move, and we don't have to aim it, because it's a fisheye lens. It can see the entire sky. We call it Clesthera's eye. Clesthera, that's the monster from ancient mythology that could look in all directions at once. Exactly. What's the use of it? I thought the point of a telescope was to focus in on one thing, not to look at everything. These things were installed in Stonehenges all over the world around the time of the Big Nugget, when people were very interested in asteroids. You're right that they're useless if you want to focus in on something, but they're great for recording the track of a fast-moving object across the sky, like the long streak of light that a meteorite draws. By recording all of those and measuring them, we can draw conclusions about what kinds of rocks are falling out of the sky, where they come from, what they're made of, how big they are. But as Clesthera's eye lacked moving parts, it didn't hold Cord's attention. We had gone as high as we could go and reached the limit of her cosmographical curiosity. She drew out her pocket watch on its rippling chain and checked the time, which I pointed out was funny because she was standing on top of a clock. She didn't see the humor. I offered to show her how to read the time by checking the sun's position with respect to the megaliths, but she said maybe some other time. We descended. She was feeling late, worrying about jobs to do and errands to run, the kinds of things that people extramuros spent their whole lives fretting about. It wasn't until we reached the meadow and the Decade Gate came in view that she relaxed a little and began reviewing in her mind all that we had discussed. So what do you think of what's-her-name's assertion? Padagar? That the legend of the Enchanters is trumped up so that the Panjandrums can control us? Yeah, Padagar. Well, the problem with it is that the secular power changes from age to age. Lately, from year to year, she said. But I couldn't tell whether she was being serious. So it's awfully hard to see how they could maintain a consistent strategy over 4 millennia, I pointed out. From our point of view, it changes so often we don't even bother keeping track, except around Appert. You could think of this place as a zoo for people who just got sick of paying attention to it. I guess I sounded a little proud, a little defensive. I said goodbye to her on the threshold of the Decade Gate. We had agreed to meet again later in the week. As I walked back over the bridge, I thought that of all the people I had talked to today, I was probably the least content in my situation. And yet when I heard the system being questioned by Jezri and by Cord, I lost no time defending it and explaining why it was a good thing. This seemed crazy on the face of it.
New matter. 1. A solid, liquid, or gas having physical properties not found in naturally occurring elements or their compounds. These properties are traceable to the atomic nuclei. The process by which nuclei are assembled from smaller particles is called nucleosynthesis and generally takes place inside of old stars. It is subject to physical laws that, in a manner of speaking, congealed into their current forms shortly after the inception of the cosmos. In the 2 centuries following the reconstitution, these laws became sufficiently understood that it became possible for certain of the avowed to carry out nucleosynthesis in their laboratories, and to do it according to sets of physical laws that differed slightly from those that are natural in this cosmos. Most new matter proved to be of little practical value, but some variants were discovered and laboriously improved to produce substances that were unusually strong or supple, or whose properties could be modulated under syntactical control. As part of the first SAC reforms, the Avout were forbidden to carry out any further work on new matter. Within the mathic world, it is still produced in small quantities to make bolts, cords, and spheres. Extramuros, it is used in a number of products. The Dictionary, 4th edition, AR-3000.
Fra Leo perfected a new wrap that made him look like a parcel that had fallen from a mail train, but that could not, under any circumstances, be pulled over the face by a foe. We proved as much by trying to do it for a quarter of an hour, Leo getting more and more pleased with himself until Jezri ruined the mood by asking whether it could stop bullets. Cord came back, accompanied by one Rosk, a young man with whom she was having some sort of liaison. They had supper with us in the refectory. She wore fewer wrenches and more jewelry, all of which she had made herself out of titanium. Archibald managed to walk to the basilica unmolested, but his father refused to talk to him, unless his purpose in coming was to repent and be consecrated into the Orthodox Bayesian faith. Leo roamed the faubourgs in the hopes that he would be set upon by a gang of thugs, but instead, people kept offering him rides and buying him drinks. Jezri's family filtered back into town, and he went to visit them from time to time. I accompanied him once and was struck by their intelligence, their polish, and, as usual, how much stuff they owned. But there was nothing underneath. They knew many things, but had no idea why. And strangely, this made them more, rather than less, certain that they were right. Stung by Jessery's earlier remarks, Leo persuaded some of his new friends to take him out to an abandoned quarry in the foothills, where people amused themselves by discharging projectile weapons at things that didn't move. His bolt and sphere became targets. The, presumably naked, Leo took up arms against two of his three possessions, assaulting them with bullets and broad-headed arrows. Bullets apparently passed through the weave of the bolt. The new matter fibers stretched to let them go through, leaving gaps that could later be massaged away. But the razor-sharp arrows cut some of the fibers and left irreparable holes in the garment. The sphere, however, distorted and stretched without limit, like a sheet of caramel if you try to shove your finger through it. The bullets poked it nearly inside out and knocked it back like a batted balloon. Leo's verdict was that the sphere could be used as a defense against gunfire. The bullet would still penetrate your body, but it would pull a long, stretchy finger of sphere stuff behind it, which would prevent fragmentation or tumbling, and which could be used to pull the bullet out of the wound. We were all much comforted by this. Cord came back for yet another visit, this time without Rosk. We had a nice stroll around the math and even went into the upper labyrinth for a look round. The conversation was first about where various members of our family had ended up, and later about where she hoped she'd be at the next Appert. 8 days into Appert, I was sick of it and thoroughly mixed up. I had a crush on my Sib. This might mean all kinds of bad things about me. As I thought about it more, though, I saw it was not the kind of crush where I wanted to have a liaison with her. I would think about her all day, care too much what she thought of me, and wish she would come around more often and pay attention to me. Then I'd remember that in a few days the gate would close and I wouldn't have any contact with her for 10 years. She seemed never to have lost sight of this and had kept a certain distance. Anyway, I reckoned, the parts of the consent that were most interesting to her were those that concerned the Eta, and in a sense, she had access to that all the time because she made stuff for them. On any given day of Appert, I could have written an entire book about what I was thinking and feeling, and it would have been completely different from the previous day's book. But by the end of the 8th day, the thing had been settled in such a way that I can sum it up much more briefly.
Liaison. 1. In old and later Orth, an intimate, typically sexual, relationship among some number of Fras and Surs. The number is almost always 2. The most common arrangement is for one of these to be a Fra and the other a Sur of approximately the same age. Liaisons are of several types. 4 types were mentioned by Ma Cartes in the Discipline. She forbade all of them. Later in the old Mathic age, a liaison between Sant Per and Sant Eleth became famous when their hordes of love letters were unearthed following their deaths. Shortly before the rebirth, several maths took the unusual step of altering the discipline to sanction the perilithian liaison, meaning a permanent liaison between one Fra and one Sur. The revised Book of Discipline, adopted at the time of the Reconstitution, described 8 types and sanctioned 2. The second new revised Book of Discipline describes 17, sanctions 4, and winks at 2 others. Each of the sanctioned liaisons is subject to certain rules and is solemnized by an ought in which the participants agree, in the presence of at least 3 witnesses, to abide by those rules. Orders or consents that deviate from the discipline by sanctioning other types of liaisons are subject to disciplinary action by the Inquisition. It is permissible, however, for an order or consent to sanction fewer types. Those that sanction 0 types are, of course, nominally celibate. 2. A late praxic age bullshit term, as such, impossible to define clearly, but apparently having something to do with contacts or relations between entities. The Dictionary, 4th edition, AR 3000.
Fra Orlo had noticed how distracted I was and summoned me to the Starhenge shortly before sunset. He'd reserved the telescope of Sons Mithra and Mylax for the night. The weather was cloudy, but in the hope that it would clear up, he had gone there late in the afternoon to aim the telescope and prepare a blank photomnemonic tablet. I found him at the controls of the M&M just as he was finishing these preparations. We went out and strolled along the ring of megaliths. My tongue was a long time in loosening, but after a while I told Orlo of what I'd been feeling and thinking about Cord. He asked all sorts of questions I'd never have thought of and listened carefully to my answers, all of which seemed to confirm in his mind that I wasn't feeling anything about her that was inappropriate for a Sib. Orlo reminded me that Cord was all the biological family I had left, not to mention the only person I really knew from Extramuros, and assured me that it was normal and healthy for me to think about her a lot. I told him about the conversations I'd been having lately that called into question all kinds of things about the discipline and the reconstitution. He assured me that this was an unwritten tradition of Apert. This was a time for the avowed to get all of that out of their systems so that they did not have to spend the next 10 years worrying about it. He slowed and stopped as we rounded the northeastern limb.
"Did you know that we live in a beautiful place?" he asked.
"How could I not know it?" I demanded. "Every day I go into the minster, I see the chancel, we sing the anathem."
"Your words say yes, your defensive tone says something else," Orlo said. "You haven't even seen this." And he gestured to the northeast.
The range of mountains leading off in that direction was obscured during winter by clouds and during summer by haze and dust. But we were between summer and winter now. The previous week had been hot, but temperatures had fallen suddenly on the second day of Apert, and we had plumped our bolts up to winter thickness. When I had entered the Presidium a couple of hours earlier, it had been storming, but as I descended the stair, the roar of the rain and the hail had gradually diminished. By the time I had found Orlo up top, nothing remained of the storm except for a few wild drops hurtling around on the wind like rocks in space, and a foam of tiny hailstones on the walkway. We were almost in the clouds. The sky had hurled itself against the mountains like a sea attacking a stony headland, and spent its cold energy in half an hour. The clouds were dissolving, yet the sky did not get any brighter because the sun was going down. But Orlo, with his cosmographer's eye, had noted on the flank of a mountain a stretched patch that was brighter than the rest. When I first saw what he was pointing at, I guessed that hail had silvered the boughs of trees in some high vale. But as we watched, the color of it warmed. It broadened, brightened, and crept up the mountainside, setting fire to individual trees that had changed color early. It was a ray coming through a gap in the weather far to the west, levering up as the sun sank.
"That is the kind of beauty I was trying to get you to see,"
Orlo told me.
"Nothing is more important than that you see and love the beauty that is right in front of you. Or else you will have no defense against the ugliness that will hem you in and come at you in so many ways."
From Fra Orlo, of all people, this was an astonishingly poetic and sentimental remark. I was so startled that it didn't occur to me to wonder what Orla was referring to when he spoke of the ugliness. At least my eyes were open, though, to what he wanted me to see. The light on the mountain became rich in hues of crimson, gold, peach, and salmon. Over the course of a few seconds, it washed the walls and towers of the Millenarian Math with a glow that, if I were a Deolater, I'd have called holy and pointed to as proof that there must be a god.
"Beauty pierces through like that ray through the clouds," Orlo continued. "Your eye is drawn to where it touches something that is capable of reflecting it, but your mind knows that the light does not originate from the mountains and the towers. Your mind knows that something is shining in from another world. Don't listen to those who says it's in the eye of the beholder."
By this, Orlo meant the Fras of the New Circle and the old reformed Faunites, but he could just as well have been Telenes, warning Ophid not to be seduced by Svenic demagogues. The light lingered on the highest parapet for a minute, then faded. Suddenly all before us was deep greens, blues, and purples.
"It'll be good seeing tonight," Orlo predicted.
"Will you stay?"
"No, we must go down. We're already in trouble with the Master of the Keys. I must go fetch some notes."
Orlo hustled away and left me alone for a minute. I was surprised by a little sunrise above the mountains. The ray, sweeping invisibly up through empty sky, had found a couple of small, wispy clouds and set them alight, like balls of wool flung into a fire. I looked down into the dark consent and felt no desire to jump. Seeing beauty was going to keep me alive. I thought of Cord and the beauty that she had, in the things she made, the way she carried herself, the emotions that played on her face while she was thinking. In the consent, beauty more often lay in some theoric proof, a kind of beauty that was actively sought and developed. In our buildings and music, beauty was always present, even if I didn't notice. Orlo was onto something. When I saw any of those kinds of beauty, I knew I was alive. And not just in the sense that when I hit my thumb with a hammer, I knew I was alive, but rather in the sense that I was partaking of something. Something was passing through me that it was in my nature to be a part of. This was both a good reason not to die and a hint that death might not be everything. I knew I was perilously close to Deolator territory now, but because people could be so beautiful, it was hard not to think that there was something of people that came from the other world that Canoas had seen through the clouds. Orlo met me at the top of the stairs, notes under his arm. Before we began our descent, he took one last look at the stars and planets beginning to come out, like a butler counting the spoons. We went down in silence, lighting our way with our spheres. Fra Gredic, the Master of the Keys, was waiting by the portcullis just as Fra Orlo had predicted. Another, slighter person stood next to him. As we came down the buttress, we saw that it was Gredic's superior, Sir Trustinus.
"Ugh, looks like we're going to get penance," I muttered. "This just demonstrates your point."
"Which point do you mean?"
"The ugliness coming in from all directions."
"I don't think this is that," Fra Orlo said. "This is something exceptional."
We stepped down into the stone cupola and crossed the threshold. Gredic slammed the grid down behind us with too much force. I looked at his face, thinking he was angry we'd made him wait. But that wasn't it. He was unsettled. He only wanted to get out of there. We all watched him fumble with his key ring. As he was locking the portcullis down, I looked north to the Unarian's cupola and then east to the Centenarian's. Both of their gridirons were also closed. Maybe some thousander cosmographer was going to use the Starhenge tonight. Or maybe the whole thing had been shut down, a security precaution for Appert. I expected Gredic to leave so that Sir Tristanus could give me and Orlo a scolding. But Gredic looked me in the eye and said,
"Come with me, Fid Erasmus."
"Where to?"
I asked. It was unusual for the Master of the Keys to make such a request, It wasn't his job.
Anywhere, he said,
and then nodded toward the head of the stairs that would lead us down. I looked at Orlo, who shrugged and made the same nod. Then I looked at Sir Trustinus, who only stared back at me, putting on a show of patience. She was early in her fourth decade of life, and not unattractive. She was brisk and organized and confident, the kind of woman who in the secular world might have gone into commerce and scampered up the hierarchy of a firm. During her first months as warden regulant, she had handed out a lot of penance for small infractions that her predecessor would have ignored. Older Avout had assured me that this was typical behavior for a new warden regulant. I was so certain that she was going to give me an Orlo penance for being late that I hesitated to leave before she had done so. But it was clear that she had come here for another purpose. So I took my leave of Trustinus and Orlo and began descending the stairs, followed by Fra Gredic. When Trustinus judged that Gredic and I were far enough away, she began telling Orlo something in a low voice. She talked for a minute or so, as if delivering a little speech that she had prepared. When Orlo answered, which he did only after a long pause, it was in a voice that was wound up tight. He was making some kind of argument, and it was not the cool voice that he used when he was in dialogue. Something had upset him. From this, I knew that Sir Trustinus had not given him penance, because that was something one had to accept meekly, lest it be doubled and doubled again. They were talking about something more important than that. And Sir Trustinus had obviously told Gredic to get me out of that place so that she and Orlo could have privacy. This was not a very satisfying end to the conversation that Orlo and I had shared on the Starhenge. But it was further proof of the point he had made, and a challenge for me to put the idea into practice.
You must have this and hold to it, or you'll die.
By the time I awoke the next morning, I could not recall whether this was something Orlo had said in so many words or a resolution that had formed in my own mind. Anyway, I woke up exhilarated and determined. In the refectory, I saw Frau Orlo sitting alone several tables away. He gave me a tight smile and looked away in the next instant. He did not wish to fill me in on his argument with Sir Trustinus. He ate quickly, then got up and headed in the direction of the Decade Gate for another day on the town. More important than the argument with Trustinus was my conversation with Orlo just before. I knew I could not talk about this in the refectory. It would not survive Dyax's rake. It would not be considered sound by the Avout. Those of a more Prokian bent would say I'd become a kind of diolater. I'd be unable to defend myself without invoking all kinds of ideas that would sound ridiculously fuzzy-minded to them. At the same time, though, I knew that this was how the Saints had done it. They judged the oracle proofs not logically but aesthetically. I wasn't the only one with a lot on his mind. Arcibald sat alone, ate practically nothing, and then skulked out. Later, Tullia picked up her bowl and came over and sat by me, which made me happy until I understood that she only wanted to talk about him. Arcibald had been doing a lot of brooding, and he had been doing it in conspicuous places, as much as demanding that we ask him what was wrong. I'd refused to do so because I found it such an annoying tactic. But Sir Tullia had been checking on him from time to time. She let me know I ought to go and see him. I did so only because the request had come from her. After the reconstitution, the first Fras and Sors of the Order of St. Edhar had come to this place where the river scoured around a ramp of stone and attacked it with explosives and water jet cutters, cleaning away the scree and rotten rock, which they moved to the perimeter and piled up to fashion the Consent's walls, until they hit the sound stone at the heart of the mountain. This they cleaved off in slabs and prisms that tumbled to the valley floor, sometimes rolling almost to the walls before they came to rest. The ramp became a knob. The knob was sharpened to a crag. The first thousanders whittled a narrow meandering stair up its face and went up there one day and never came back again, but pitched a camp on its top and set to working building their own walls and towers. The valley below remained a rubble field for centuries.
The Avowed swarmed over the strewn stones wherever they had come to rest and carved out of them the pieces of the minster. Almost all of them were gone now, and the land was flat, fertile, and stoneless. But a few of the great boulders were still dotted around the meadow, partly for decoration and partly as raw materials for our stonecutters, who were still fiddling with the minster's gargoyles, finials, and such. I found Archibald perched on the top of a boulder, surrounded by empty beverage containers that had been strewn around the place by slines. All around him, visitors were sleeping it off in the tall grass. Across the meadow, Leo was cavorting around a statue of Saint Froga, flinging the end of his bolt out and letting it waft over the statue's head, then snapping it back like a whip. I wouldn't have looked twice if this hadn't been Appert, but there were visitors on the meadow, watching, pointing, laughing, and speely capturing. Another useful function of Appert, to be reminded of how weird we were, and how fortunate to live in a place where we could get away with it. Exhibit A, Fra Archibald. Speaking whole paragraphs, complete with topic sentences in perfect Middle Orth, with footnotes in Old and Proto-Orth, he explained that he felt aggrieved by his father's refusal to talk to him, because he was not so much abjuring his father's faith as trying to build a bridge between it and the Mathic world. This struck me as an ambitious project for a 19-year-old to undertake, 7,000 years after the two daughters of Canoas had stopped speaking to each other. Still, I heard him out, partly so that I could later impress Tullia with what a good guy I was, partly because I didn't want to be a Lorite, but also partly because what Archibald was saying was nearly as crazy as my discussion with Orlo the evening before. And so, perhaps, after I had heard Archibald out, he would let me confide some of my thoughts. But as the conversation, if listening to Archibald talk could be called that, went on, this hope curdled. It had not crossed his mind that I too might have some things I wanted to discuss, perhaps not as clever or as momentous as what was on his mind, but important to me. I bided my time, and just when I saw an opening, he changed the subject altogether and ambushed me with a rhapsody about the exquisite chord. And so, instead of talking about what I wanted to talk about, I was forced to come to grips with the idea of chord as being exquisite. He wondered whether she might be open to an Atlanean liaison. I thought not, but who was I to judge? And a boyfriend who was, A, sterile, and, B, only allowed out once every 10 years, seemed like a safe boyfriend to have. So I shrugged and allowed that anything was possible. Then back to Sewer Tullia to file a report. 17 years ago, Tullia had been found at the day gate, wrapped in newspapers and nestled in a beer cooler with the lid ripped off. The stump of her umbilical cord had already fallen off, which meant that she was too old and too touched by the secular world to be accepted by the Thousanders. Anyway, she had been sickly at first, and so she had been kept in the Unarian Math, which was more convenient to physicians' commons. There she had been raised, as I pictured it, by the doting burghers' wives and daughters who populated that math, until she had graduated through the labyrinth at the age of 6. She had emerged, all alone, from our side of the maze, and gravely introduced herself to the first sewer she saw. Anyway, she had no family on the outside. Watching the rest of us cope with our families during Appert had led her to understand how very fortunate she might be. She was too deft to say anything, but it was clear she had spent the whole time being bemused at the rest of us. She had seen me strolling around chatting with my Sib and concluded that everything was fine and simple for me. I sensed it would boot me nothing to try to explain to her what I had discussed with Orlo. So, instead, I talked to groups of total strangers from Extramuros who showed up to take tours of the Unarian Math. My math was small, simple, and quiet. The Unarian Math, by contrast, had been built to overawe people who came in from outside. 10 days out of each year, groups of Extramuros tourists, and the rest of the time, those who'd made a vow to spend at least 1 year in it. Few of these graduated to the Decenarian Math. Burgers' wives trying to feel something was an especially cruel description I had once heard from an old fra.
As often, they were younger, unmarried, and looking for the final coat of polish and prestige needed to go out into adult society and seek a mate. Some studied under Halicarnians and became praxics or artisans. Others studied under Procyons. These tended to go into law, communications, or politics. Jezri's mother had done 2 years here just after she had turned 20. Not long after coming out, she had married Jezri's father, a somewhat older man who had put in 3 years and used what he had learned to start a career doing whatever it was he did.
Plane. 1. In Dyaxin Theorix, a two-dimensional manifold in three-dimensional space having a flat metric. 2. An analogous manifold in higher-dimensional space. 3. A flat expanse of open ground in the pericline of ancient Ethras, originally used by theoricians as a convenient place to scratch proofs in the dirt, later as a place to conduct dialogues of all types. 4. Used as a verb, utterly to destroy an opponent's position in the course of a dialogue. The Dictionary, 4th edition, AR 3000.
Around dawn of the 10th day of Apert, Sir Aranda, who was one of the beekeepers, discovered that during the night, some ruffians had found their way into the apiary shed, smashed some crockery, and made off with a couple of cases of mead. Nothing so exciting had happened in eons. When I came into the refectory to break my fast, everyone was talking about it. They were still talking about it when I left, which was at about 7. I was due at the year gate at 9. The easy way to get there would have been to go extramuros through the decade gate, walk north through the burgher's town, and approach it from the outside. But thinking about Tullia yesterday had given me the idea of getting there through our lower labyrinth, retracing the steps she had taken at the age of 6. Supposedly, she had made it through in about half a day. I hoped that at my age I could get through it in an hour, but I allowed 2 hours just to be on the safe side. It ended up taking me an hour and a half. As the clock struck 9, I stood, formally wrapped and hooded, at the foot of the bridge that led to the year gate, which rose up before me in its crenellated bastion. Bridge and gate were of similar design to those in the Decenarian math, but twice as big and much more richly decorated. On the first day of Apert, 400 had thronged the plaza that I could now see through the year gate, and cheered as their friends and family had poured out at sunrise to end their year of seclusion. This morning's tour group numbered about 24. A third of them were uniformed 10-year-olds from a Bayesian Orthodox Suvin, or so I guessed from the fact that their teacher was in a nun's habit. The others seemed a typical mix of burghers, artisans, and slines. The latter were recognizable from a distance. They were huge. Some artisans and burghers were huge too, but they wore clothes intended to hide it. The current slime fashion was to wear a garment evolved from an athletic jersey, bright with numerals on the back, but oversized, so that shoulder seams hung around the elbows, and extremely long, descending all the way to the knee. The trousers were too long to be shorts and too short to be pants. They hung a hand's breadth below the jersey, but still exposed a few inches of chunky calf, plunging into enormous, thickly padded shoes. Headgear was a burnous blazoned with beverage logos whose loose ends trailed down the back, and dark goggles strapped over that and never removed, even indoors. But it was not only clothing that set the slines apart. They had also adopted fashions in how they walked, a rolling, sauntering gait, and how they stood, a pose of exaggerated cool that somehow looked hostile to me. So I could see even from a distance that I had 4 slines in my tour group this morning. This troubled me not at all, because during the previous 9 days there had been no serious trouble on the tours. Fra Degelos had concluded that the slines of this era subscribed to a harmless iconography. They were not half as menacing as their postures. I backed up onto the crest of the bridge to get a little altitude. Once the group had formed up below me, I greeted them and introduced myself. The Suvin kids stood in a neat row in the front. The slines stood together in the back, maintaining some distance to emphasize their exceptional cool, and thumbed their gee-jaws or suckled from bucket-sized containers of sugar water. Two latecomers were hustling across the plaza, and so I went a little slowly at first, so as not to strand them. I had learned not to expect much in the way of attention span, and so after pointing out the orchard of page trees and the tangles on this side of the river, I led them over to the bridge, into the heart of the Unarian Math. We skirted a wedge-shaped slab of red stone, carved all over with the names of the Fras and Sors whose remains lay underneath it. It was our policy not to talk about this unless someone asked. Today, no one did, and so a lot of awkwardness was avoided. The third sack had opened with a week-long siege of the Consent. The walls were far too long to be defended by so few, and so on the third day the Tenors and Hundreders had broken the discipline and withdrawn to the Unarian Math, which was somewhat easier to defend because it had a smaller perimeter that included some water barriers. The Thousanders, of course, were safe up on their crag. By the time the siege was 2 weeks old, it had become obvious that the secular power had no intention of coming to their aid. Before dawn one day, most of the Avout gathered behind the Year Gate, threw it open, and stormed out across the plaza in a flying wedge, driving through the surprised besiegers and into the town. For 1 hour, they sacked the town and the besiegers' supply dumps, gathering medicines, vitamins, ammunition, and all that they could find of certain chemicals and minerals that could not be obtained within the Consent. Then they did something even more astonishing to the attackers, which was that instead of running away, they formed up into another wedge, much smaller by this point, and fought their way back across the plaza and went back in the gate. They didn't stop until they had crossed the bridge, which was immediately dropped by explosives. There they threw down the stuff they had scavenged and collapsed. 500 had stormed out. 300 had come back. Of those, 200 died on the spot from wounds suffered during the operation. This wedge of granite was their tumulus. The stuff that they had gathered was sent up to the Thousanders. The rest of the Consent fell the next day. The Thousanders lived alone and untouched on their crag for the next 70 years. Besides ours, only two other Millenarian Maths in the world had made it through the third sack unviolated and unsacked. Though in many cases, there had been enough warning that Avout had been able to run away, carrying what they could in the way of books, and live in remote places for the next decades. The wedge monument was aimed not out toward the city, but in toward the clock. This was to emphasize that those buried under it had returned. 50 paces from its vertex lay the entrance of the Hylian Way. After the Minster, this was the dominant architectural feature of the Consent. The style of these buildings was more Bayesian than Mathic, less vertical, more horizontal, reminding people of arcs, which traditionally spread wide to welcome all comers. I held the door open long enough for the two latecomers to scurry inside, then closed it, content, maybe even smug, in the knowledge that Barb was not with us. During the first 2 days of Appert, the son of Quinn had attended almost every one of these tours. After memorizing every word that the guide said, he had begun to ask crippling numbers of questions. From there he had moved on to correcting the Fras and Sors whenever they had said something wrong, and amplifying their remarks when they were insufficiently long-winded. A couple of wily Sors had found other ways to keep him busy, but it was difficult to keep him focused for long, and so he would still make occasional strafing runs. Quinn and his ex-wife seemed content to give Barb the run of the Consent at all hours, which was as good as telling us that they wanted him collected. The architects of the Hylian Way had played a little trick by making its grand-looking entrance lead to a space that was unexpectedly dark and close, suggestive of a labyrinth, but not nearly that complicated. The walls and floors were made from slabs of greenish-brown shale quarried from a deposit that fascinated naturalists because of the profusion of early life forms fossilized in it. I explained as much to the group as we all waited for our eyes to adjust to the dimness, then invited them to spend a few minutes looking at the fossils. Those who'd had the foresight to bring a source of light, such as the Suvin kids and some of the retired burghers, dispersed into the corners of the chamber. The nun had brought a map so that she knew just where to look for the really weird fossils. I circulated among the others with a basket of hand lights. Some accepted them, Some waved me off. Probably these were counter-Bayesian fundamentalists who believed that Arbor had been created all at once in its present form shortly before the time of Canoas. They ignored this phase of the tour as a silent protest. A few more wore earbuds and listened to recorded tours on Jijas. The slines only stared at me and made no response. I noticed that one of them had his arm in a sling. It took me a few moments to place this memory. Then I drew the obvious conclusion that this was the very group that had attacked Leo and Arcibald. I felt helpless in my formal wrap, the one that could easily be pulled down over the face, and wished I'd paid more attention to how Leo had been wearing his bolt lately. Backing away from them, I announced, "This chamber is two things at once. On the one hand, it's an exhibit of ancient fossils, mostly weird and funny-looking ones that did not evolve into any creatures known to us today. Evolutionary dead ends. At the same time, this place is a symbol for the world of thought as it existed before Canoas. In that age, there was a zoo of different thought ways, most of which would seem crazy to us now. These two were evolutionary dead ends. They are extinct, except among primitive tribes in remote places." As I was saying this, I was leading them around a couple of turns toward a much bigger and brighter space. "They are extinct," I continued, "because of what happened to this man as he was walking along a riverbank 7,000 years ago." And I stepped forth into the rotunda, quickening my pace to draw the group along in my wake. A long pause now, so as not to ruin the moment. The central sculpture was more than 6,000 years old. It had been a world-famous masterpiece for almost that long. How it had found its way to this continent and this rotunda was a long and lively story in itself. It was of white marble, double life-size, though it seemed even bigger because it was up on a huge stone pedestal. It was Canoas, aged but muscular, with long wavy beard and hair, sprawled back against the gnarled roots of a tree, staring up in awe and astonishment. As if to shield himself from the vision, he had raised a hand, but could not resist the temptation to peek over it. Gripped in his other hand was a stylus. Tumbled at his feet were a ruler, a compass, and a tablet graven with precisely constructed circles and polygons. Barb hadn't looked at the ceiling when he had come in here for the first time. This was because Barb's brain was so organized that he was blind to facial expressions. Everyone else, even I who had seen it many times, looked up to see what was having such an effect on poor old Canoas. The answer, at least ever since the statue had been installed here, was an oculus, or a hole at the apex of the rotunda dome, shaped like an isosceles triangle and letting in a beam of sunlight. "Canoas was a master stonemason," I began. "On one ancient tablet, which was made before he had his vision, he is described by an adjective that literally means one who is elevated. This might mean either that he was especially good at being a stonemason or that he was some kind of holy man in the religion of his place and time. At the command of his king, he was building a temple to a god. The stone was quarried from a place a couple of miles upriver and floated down to the building site on rafts." Here one of the slines broke in with a question, and I had to stop and explain that all of this had happened far away and that I was not speaking of our river or our quarries. A jija began to crow a ridiculous tune. I waited for its owner to stifle it before I continued. "Canoas would draw up measurements on a wax tablet and then walk up to the quarry to give instructions to the stonecutters. One day he was trying to work out a particularly difficult problem in the geometry of the piece he needed to have cut. Under the shade of a tree that grew on the riverbank, he sat down to work on this problem, and there he had a vision that changed his mind and his life." Everyone agrees on that much, but his description of that vision comes to us indirectly, through these women. I extended my arm toward a pair of slightly smaller sculptures, which, inevitably, formed an isosceles triangle with that of Canoas. "His daughters Hylea and Deot, thought to be fraternal twins." Counter-Bayesians were way ahead of me. They had already moved to the foot of Deot and knelt down to pray. Some were rummaging in their bags for candles. Others, peering into their gee-jaws as they snapped phototypes, stumbled and collided. Dayot was a cloaked figure sunk to her knees, facing toward Canoas, her garment shielding her face from the light of the oculus. Our mother Hylaea, by contrast, stood erect, pulling her cloak back to bare her head, the better to gaze straight up into the light. With her other hand, she was pointing at it, and her lips were parted, as if she were just beginning to offer up some observation.